encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome in, listeners, to another episode of the Fergie Fledglings. We are back with the regular crew. I'm joined by Nathan Heinchel and Polly Questel on this Monday after Manchester United's 1-0 defeat to Crystal Palace on Saturday. And we're going to start talking about the match first. There's some more injury news to get to. Obviously, Lisandro Martinez is the main one. But this, a second straight home defeat for Manchester United in the Premier League, already doubling their tally from last year. And things are starting to snowball a little bit, aren't they, fellas?
I feel like I kind of called this when Pauly and I were recording last without you, Colin. We're looking ahead to the games that were upcoming, and it was like Crystal Palace on the midweek and Crystal Palace on the weekend, and it was like we're gonna win.
We definitely said they'd only win one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so this is the third
game, and we're definitely gonna lose the league game.
This is the third season in a row that Manchester United has had back-to-back cup and league fixtures against the exact same team, and all three times that they've dropped one and then won the other.
It's actually the fourth season in a row.
Fourth.
Yes.
So 20 and 21. Oh, was that the West Ham year?
No. It might have. They actually might have done it twice then that year. They definitely did it at the beginning of the season. They beat Brighton when they got a penalty kick after the full time whistle, and then
that's
went
right.
back in the League Cup and demolished Brighton.
Okay, so they won both, and they beat
West Ham twice in maybe consecutive games, but maybe like there might have been a game in between there.
Wasn't Wolves in there? Like it was Bruno Fernandes' debut.
No,
did
that
we
was
play
the year
Wolves
before.
Twice.
No, that was just they played Wolves in the FA Cup.
That was the year before
FA Cup replay, and then
that's right.
A couple games later they played Wolves in the league.
Right.
No, but they then were... the following year Brighton did they play West Ham twice? I don't know. That was under a different manager. Ever since they changed managers, they've had three of them, and they have not won.
Yeah,
back to back.
Seems not good.
Right, because two seasons ago it was Aston Villa. Last season it was Aston Villa. Nah. Yeah, last season was Aston Villa. 2 years ago it was West Ham. This time it was Crystal Palace, which I'm starting with. No, they were just close together last year.
Oh, right.
Anyway,
yeah, no,
the match itself. the match itself. Polly, you wrote a little bit about it and how we've seen kind of the trend throughout the season of Manchester United will start games well against some of the weaker opponents. They'll possess the ball, but they just have a very serious problem of getting the ball in the back of the net, or even more than that, creating the chances that make it likely to put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, I don't even think they started this match well so much as this was like this was sort of something you don't see it as often anymore as you did 10, 15 years ago, or even 5 years ago or 4 years ago. But Crystal Palace just straight up were like, yeah, we're low blocking. And that's that. And so it was like 8 minutes, 5 minutes into the game at the bar. I was just like, let me just say this. I'm very happy Crystal Palace have no interest in playing with us. I was like, that's going to make it easier, but still challenge cut out for you. And it just looked like that like old school mentality of like, yeah, we'll come into Old Trafford, set up in a block, maybe get something on a corner, on a counterattack, maybe nick a set piece. And you know, if all goes well and we get one goal from that, we can maybe get out of here with a 1-1 draw. Or if we, you know, defend stoutly, then maybe we can steal a win. But we're going to put the onus on Manchester United. We are going to make Manchester United take the game to us. And United just didn't. They very much did not. And this looked like this looked like the first half of the 2019-2020 season when everybody would get on Solskjaer and be like, you can't break down a low block. And because the team struggled to do that. And they've had this issue in the past. You know, back then, that's what people that did not like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would say. Like, he can't break down a low block. He can only counterattack. And people that liked him would be like, well, we're also missing Anthony Martial and Paul Pogba and Luke Shaw. And then they'd be like, and then you'd watch the next week and Liverpool would face a low block and they'd get some disgusting deflected 83rd minute goal to get a 1-0 win. And you'd be like, yeah, that wasn't pretty either. Jurgen Klopp struggles to do this. And people would be like, don't. And, you know, people that didn't like Solskjaer would be like, don't compare him to Jurgen Klopp. And then the next week you'd watch Manchester City lose 2-1 or 1-0 against a low block and be like, Pep can't do it either. It is not easy to do. But the argument back then was, well, the injuries don't matter. If you had a better coach with better patterns, it would happen. And now they've got their patterns and they just look entirely too predictable. They do the same thing every time. There are injuries. Luke Shaw is out again. But that was the argument 4 years ago that these patterns should compensate for the injuries. And they're just not. And it just, it looked so gross. Because again, if one team sets up in a low block, you're not going to watch a thrilling match of football. That's just the way it is. But they just looked completely devoid of ideas.
Yeah. I think it's worth pointing out, you know, before maybe diving into the match or specific moments, a lot of the talk again has started to shift, you know, when things are negative at Manchester United, it seems like things shift towards blaming one particular player. And in this instance, it's starting to become Marcus Rashford again, particularly on social media, which I think we can just assume why for some circles of fans, Marcus Rashford continues to be a target. But when the strategy is just to get him the ball and make him make things happen, like, what the hell else is he supposed to do other than, you know, run at defenders and run to the byline? Like, there was a 10-minute period where Manchester United looked like they were switching on, and they created three chances. I think two of them were on goal.
In like the 50-something minute, right?
Yeah, it was like the 50th minute to the 60th minute. And then Erik ten Hag is like, okay, I'm going to move Rashford to the right, away from, you know, his preferred position so that I can bring on Garnacho. He takes off Mason Mount not long after that, I believe. And then he withdraws Rashford. And it's like every single decision that he made to try and alter the course of the match just surrendered the game to Crystal Palace. A game that was very winnable if United were up for it. Because Crystal Palace had one, maybe two good chances other than the goal that they scored. And the goal that they
legitimately
scored...
Legitimately, too.
Yep, the goal that they scored was just like a defender hitting a volley. Like,
perfect strike. But how we got to that point was at one point, finally, 25 minutes into the match, Crystal Palace decided, let's come out of our shell. And United turned the ball over four times in 55 seconds. Three of them were Casemiro. Two of them were just Casemiro not realizing that someone might be behind him and running behind him to steal the ball off him. And they were trying to play out it was like four turnovers, and three of them, I would say, would be classified in your own third. One of them, they made the pass out to the middle third and then probably lost it there. Ball never crossed the halfway line. And this is United's thing. Like, this is their philosophy. They are going to try to play out the back, and they're going to try to keep possession at all times. And that's fine. Look, if you just hoof it away, you're basically giving the ball back to the other team and saying, come attack us again. If you keep possession, then the other team can't attack you. But at a certain point, when you keep turning the ball over, players are going to get frustrated, especially when it's, you know, the player who keeps turning it over is bound to get frustrated because he's like, I got to make up for these mistakes. Other players are going to be like, God, again. And we just got to get the ball. We just got to do something. At a certain point, you just got to get the ball and just hoof it away, turn around and yell at your teammates, wake the F up. And at that point, and also get a chance to catch your breath and reform your lines and get your balance back. At one point, Sofyan Amrabat was playing central midfield, and Jordan Ayew just was like, he was looking at Victor Lindelof and he was like, I have the entire right side ahead of me because there's no left back. And credit to Amrabat, he ran back and he trapped Ayew, but like he ends up running full speed back to the byline. It's like, give him a chance to catch his breath and like get back into left back position. And they never did that. And what ultimately happens is Amrabat gives away a ridiculously avoidable, unnecessary foul. And those are always the type of fouls that seem to end up in the back of your net.
Particularly for a team that has a narrative of conceding set piece goals.
Yeah. They have not gotten better on then. And Palace's they had the other chance. Their other chance was the cutback goal that United have conceded so many times this season. Palace did get a cutback. He did hit it squarely. Andre Onana made the save. And then on the ensuing corner, Palace got their third good look of the game. And that was that. It goes on to this theme, though, of as soon as something bad happens, the heads start to drop and the players, they don't seem to have any faith in anything. And they start to press a little bit more and try to do it all themselves. Within a minute of United going 1-0 down, Casemiro took a 29-yard shot on a half volley and he just missed, but that doesn't, like, the outcome there should not distract you from the fact that that was a really bad shot. So like United got it. They had the ball right outside the box. They were looking to attack. And instead Casemiro just a ball bounces and he just swings his foot through it. And that's what happened. Like there was another one early in the second half where Hoyland got it and turned and ran upfield and he played it out wide to Pulisic, but he played it a little bit too late and a little bit too slow. So it kind of died, and then like Pulisic got it back to somebody and they were in the box, but it was like kind of ridiculous that they didn't get a shot. Like, and eventually it came right to Bruno at the top of the box and he just with his left foot tried to shoot it because it was like, you could see the frustration of like, how did we not get a shot from this here? I'm going to shoot. And like, obviously it was blocked because there was a defender right there. And there was no thought there other than I'm frustrated that we didn't get a shot. And it was right after that that Bruno got that shot that Sam Johnstone made that really nice save on. Yeah, but that just seemed to be the rest of the game was not a lot of combination play. They United launched 33 crosses into the box. They completed two of them. They just seemed devoid of ideas. And the fact that it happens every time they go 1-0 down that they lose their heads like this is a sign that says the players don't believe in the plan and whatever the plan was. And maybe the plan only is give the ball to Rashford and wait for him to do something while we don't give him a supporting fullback or anything that might help him out. It just shows that it seems like the players don't have faith right now.
Nathan, I couldn't remember if it was you or Casey that made the Sam Johnstone masterclass tweet on Tuesday. But
I believe it was Casey, but okay. I think we were all thinking it.
Yeah. I mean, Palace had two shots with two goalkeepers to have a former United goalkeeper masterclass at Old Trafford last week. And, Sam Johnstone came on in the 20th minute of the cup match. Yeah. And then he saw two goals go past him within the first like 6 minutes that he was on the pitch. So that was a little rough for him, but, whenever he was tested on Saturday, it definitely felt like, oh, we finally get a shot on target. And of course, he makes a great save.
Well, we only got three shots on target.
Yeah.
You know, Nathan, and
they all
that.
Came.
Nathan uses
that
stat
minute.
All the time. Nathan uses that stat all the time. And I always yell at him, like, don't use shots on target to just judge how the attack was. But in this particular case, it really emphasized how 19 shots and three on target is because they took a lot of bad shots that were not easy to get on target. And therefore they did not go on target. Even in the game, like even Tuesday night in the League Cup where they thoroughly demolished a Crystal Palace B team, 14 shots and a 1.2 XG. Not that much. They scored on three of them. It's not a league match. So therefore, Casemiro is basically prime Cristiano Ronaldo on a corner kick in non-league matches. And then they come back in the league and it's 19 shots for about this for 1.3 XG. Like, that's atrocious. They're 0.07 XG per shot. The league average is 0.10. Like, that's you can't expect to win games like that.
Yeah. Nathan, did you get to watch the Saturday match, or were you already at the Richmond Stadium?
I was able to watch a portion of it. I missed Crystal Palace's goal. I caught quite a bit of the second half.
I'm sorry.
I mean, there was a couple opportunities where it looked like it was a possibility. There was also, I think I tweeted out wondering, you know, why there was maybe not a handball called it at a certain point during the game as well. I think all of my troubles with what's been going on with the team are pretty in line with what Polly's been suggesting. I think what's frustrating is, you know, we've got Rasmus Højlund that we spent all this money on. And as I said, that was like a knee jerk thing that I try not to do. And, like, you know, people always put the price tag on the player, which is not fair to the player. He played a full 90 and had as many shots as Garnacho. And I don't think that's because of Hoyland's fault necessarily, but we are struggling to get him the ball. And so we're still waiting for him to score to be able to start adding to his tally. And unfortunately, it's just like right now, the way United's built, it's not designed to really get him the ball. You know, Rashford, like Paulie said, dribble or get to the byline. I mean, Casemiro led the team in shots. It's just, it got to a certain point where it felt like it was hero ball, which is not what you want the game to turn into, because I don't think this team right now has heroes outside of maybe.
And it got to that point after a half hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I mean, Casemiro is our leading scorer this season, right?
Right. But he scores a lot on set pieces.
Yeah. And I mean, two of them came in the Bayern Munich
game.
Yeah.
And right. Where he was awful. The, right. What Nathan's saying about Højlund, like, Højlund is doing, everybody said United needed a striker. And, like, I think we all kind of said, sure, get a striker. But, like, that's not the only thing they need, because they're not creating chances for a striker. It's not like Anthony Martial last season was missing chance after chance after chance that you're like, get us a striker. And they're like, get us a striker. And we're going to finish this. It was like, we still need to create more chances. And like Nathan said, you're not creating chances for Rasmus Højlund. I don't know where Antony comes back into the team. He's not someone that creates chances for the striker.
Oh, he doesn't shoot.
Yeah. So, like, where are they coming from? And that's part of the thing. Like, Højlund himself is
like, we're waiting for Luke Shaw to come back before there's like really a key chance creator on that left side.
But even that, like, Højlund.
Even, like, I mean, at this point, just any left back.
You can't be relying on just Bruno and Luke Shaw to do it. Like, that was the problem with Solskjaer's team. Was there, you need more than that, and that's why they cooked when Pogba came onto the field, and they didn't when he wasn't on the field. It was like, you need more. You need more from that right side. And that's why I think ultimately, when we do have a full strength team, I think Sofyan and Amrabat is going to line up at right back more often than we think, because he probably offers something different than Dalot and Juan Bissaka do. But Hoyland's doing enough right now where, like someone like me, I don't really care what Højlund does. I'm like, you need to develop, you need to get good. I see what is coming. I don't expect it to be here this season. I just need you to get reps and get better.
And stay healthy.
Yeah. And do that and do those things. I'm not expecting, I think you are a 20 goal scorer. I'm not expecting it this year. Someone who looks at the game differently than I do, and has different sort of expectations. He is running around, He's putting an effort. He is getting on the end of, he's getting some chances. He's getting on the end of crosses, which is something that people like to see. So like getting chances with your head and everything. So he's doing enough to keep those people on side as well. So nobody's looking at Rasmus Højlund as the issue, but like you said, Nathan, is they need to get him the ball. Like, he's not getting a lot of shots, and some of that's on him. He's got to develop a little more in certain areas so that he carves out his own shots.
And chemistry.
But also, the team needs to get too. Him the ball more.
Yeah. And I certainly hope I wasn't intending to sound unfair to Højlund, because I think...
I don't think you were.
Yeah, in the areas where he's really become the apple in everybody's eye, when he does, like, oh, we haven't seen a United striker do that in a while. Like, that's all really encouraging. I think, you know, we talked about this when he first got signed, and then we had found out that he magically had a back issue right after we signed him. You know, we tried to temper our expectations, at least on this podcast. And, yeah, I mean, I think he's flashing something really positively. And I think he could show even more, like Pauly said, if we could start setting him up to succeed better. How we do that, you know, that's not a question that I am tactically acute enough to make happen. But
I think it starts with having a position where you don't have to move someone else just to cover that position, because three of your players are injured. I think that's part of it.
Is it because we have redundancy at one position? It's like, you got Garnacho, you got Rashford. Like, that's the only position where it's like, oh, if we lose one guy, at least we have someone that can, like, slot in there. Because outside of that, we don't usually make a lot of like-for-like subs.
But, like, how did you guys feel about the changes? Because I thought, like, moving Rashford over to the right, I know we've talked about it in the past of... You know, Rashford's more of has shown that he can be a creator on the right, but it seemed like it just removed him from the game before he was eventually subbed.
Well, he wasn't in the game anyway.
Okay, yeah, but when he was over on the right, he like literally was not in the game. literally not in the game.
Okay, but this goes back like years to the United have a problem passing to the right problem. Not necessarily who's on the right. So, like when Dan James is there and they're like, he just doesn't get the ball. And then they're like, put someone actually good there. And they would put somebody actually like Juan Mata would go there. And it was like, no, he doesn't get the ball either. And it was always just like, doesn't matter who's there. Like 2 minutes into the match, Pulisic got the ball and drove at like a defender and basically went shoulder to shoulder with him and hit the floor. And everybody went, whoa, why is that not a foul? And it was like, because it's very clean. And
because he doesn't hit the weight room.
Right. And then, like, 15 minutes later, Poestri, like, drove to the byline and put in the cross, and I, like, just turned to the guy next to me, and I was like, you know, that was the first time that Poestri got the ball since he went down on that foul. Like, they just... That right side was a black hole to begin with, whether it was Poestri, whether it was Rashford. The changes had to come because you needed to do something. They weren't doing anything for 60 minutes. So Ten Hag needed to make a change in some way. And he needed to make a change because he got his starting 11 wrong. Like, that was the ultimate thing. Was I looked at this, as the team came out, and I looked at it and I went, you know, there's really nothing to be afraid of on Crystal Palace's side. But, like, what's your plan here? Your plan to move the ball from the back? Well, like, who's going to do that? Because Verona Lindelof, not really the center backs to do that. And your midfield of Mount and Casemiro, not really the guys to move the ball to. Everybody loved Amrabat on the first in the League Cup, but it was like, yeah, he got the ball a lot, but because United's left back always gets the ball a lot and he drove to the middle, but they didn't move it through the third, like through the lines. Well, like they entered the final third a lot because Palace just let them walk it across midfield. They didn't push it forward a lot. And then on the right, you know, Dalot is Dalot. And further ahead, it's pushed. So it's like, where are you going to get that? Like, this team should still have enough talent to beat Palace. No question. But I was like, this is not going to be easy or pretty. And that was by choice. Like, Palace don't have a lot coming back the other way. So why not just play the defender that is the best at moving the ball forward, even if he's not your best defensive defender?
And you can play him in his actual position.
After he just had a great game, why not be like, hey, Palace, like you're not facing Spurs, you're not facing City, you're facing Crystal Palace. Like, this is a game where it's like, we could reacclimatize you to the team, and you should not cost us here. And what you bring to the table in this game is much more than what your weaknesses are. Christian Eriksen, where was he? This is a game tailor made for Christian Eriksen. Like, this is the point of having squad players, is, and this is how you rotate your squad. You don't rotate your squad by being like, oh, you've played five games in a row, so I'm going to go to the backup now for game number six, or there was a League Cup match, so I'm going to go to the backup. You look at your squad and go, oh, no, this is a game that's tailor-made for Christian Eriksen, so I'm going to play Christian Eriksen here. And if that means that he play, you know, like, if Christian Eriksen is supposed to start 20% of the games, but that means three of those games come up in a row, then yeah, you start him three times in a row. Like, that's just the way to, like, he played against Brighton in a position that did not fit his skill set at all and was atrocious. He played against Bayern Munich, that where you were like, this is not the game for Christian Eriksen at all, and he was awful. So he got dropped for Burnley, which you were like, oh, okay, yeah, makes sense. And then missing from the League Cup with quote-unquote illness, which seems to be Ten Hag's catch-all term for, I didn't pick him, and I don't want to tell you why, unless I want to start a fight with one of my players. And then he comes back, but like, he doesn't start in this match, where it's like, this is, it seemed like he, from maybe he was injured, but when he came off the pitch against Bayern Munich, he didn't look injured. So if he was injured, it would raise questions if we're getting another injury in training. Or it's just like, it seems like from the outside looking in, it seems like you're being punished for games where you wouldn't be expected to play well. You're being punished for not playing well by not playing the games where you should, where we could really utilize your skill set. And that just doesn't see, that's not the way to rotate your squad. That's not the way to like manage your squad. And that's going to contribute to you not getting the best out of your squad.
Right. And I think it's accentuated right now because things in general have just not been going well. And they haven't found form since the first game of the season. You could argue that they haven't had the chance to because of the injury problems that we've had.
I don't think that's an excuse.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an excuse. And the left back thing, fine, but the left back thing I'll give you, because, well, as we discussed, like, in, first of all, in week one against Wolves, Garnacho struggled because Ten Hag was like, hey, Luke Shaw, we're going to play as a box midfield. Because that's what the elite teams are doing these days. That's the in vogue tactic. And everybody's like, oh, if you're not playing box midfield, that's the best rest defense. You got to do it. And Garnacho struggled because his fullback wasn't overlapping. He was standing in midfield. So, and when we saw him, Reguilon looked really bright doing that. So then you bring in Amrabat, and everybody is losing their shit over the fact that Amrabat's tucking into midfield and playing this box midfield. And, oh, this is elite rest defense and everything. But you're leaving Rashford all on his own on the left with no overlapping fullback because Amrabat's not going to do that. And it's like, whatever you're gaining out of having your fullback in midfield playing central midfield, like, you're losing so much. And
you're asking Rashford to be the kind of winger who he isn't.
Very much is not. Like, he...
Yeah.
And this is... Rashford has a tendency to disappear against deep blocks, and I've been saying that for years, and I keep thinking back to like that first half of that 2019-20 season, and it was kind of today where I was like, well, yeah, like, he scored against Liverpool and he scored against City and all those games where he can attack the space, but what did he do against Bournemouth and Newcastle and West Ham, where these teams just sat deep? I'm like, well, also, guess who was missing in those games? Luke Shaw. And when Luke Shaw came back, Rashford was once again very good, and Rashford went through another lull the following season early on. Yes, it was hurt, Luke Shaw. So I'll give you that, but also, we again against Wolves, Ten Hag chose not to use Luke Shaw as an overlapper. So, like, I'll give you the left back thing if you're going to use your left back correctly. But everything else is like, you had Mount, he's a first choice attacker. You had Fernandez, he's a first choice attacker. You had Hoyland, you had Rashford. Where, you know, those are your first choice players.
You got the ingredients. What are you going to make?
Right. And you had all of the ball. You had the most possession and the most touches than in any game in the Erik Ten Hag era. And you created nothing. So it's hard to say, like, and again, you look at the league, you look at the match on Wednesday in the League Cup where they played all the backups and that pressing structure was exactly the same. And everybody was like, this is peak Ten Hag ball. And it's like, okay, so if the backups are all picking up the system, then shouldn't this, like, you don't have an excuse for the starters not knowing. There's, you know, they're clearly all sitting in the same meetings and everything. I can't see that as an excuse. It doesn't fly with me.
Speaking of things that don't fly with me, let's segue into off the field things with Manchester United. I tried to keep this in my mind because before we started recording, we were having a conversation and Polly said, Colin, hit record. Because, you know, I was talking about things that we should talk about on the podcast and I've managed to kind of, you know, keep it in my head here. And I guess we'll start with the Lisandro Martinez injury. So the news broke yesterday that he was scheduled to have surgery today, Monday, on the same broken metatarsal that he injured against Sevilla in the Europa League quarterfinal in the spring. And Polly, this morning when you were texting about it, or maybe it was yesterday, you know, hitting it right on the head that this means he came back prematurely. And it wasn't just returning to action this season. He was a regular throughout the preseason tour. You know, he was training with the squad in the summer. He went on the tour. He featured in several games, and he's featured most of the season until, what was it, Bayern Munich, when he was finally withdrawn and it seemed like maybe something serious was happening. So now, you know, optimistic estimates, he comes back late December, early January. And that's if nothing goes wrong again.
That almost seems too ambitious again.
Yeah. And it just seems like this is another managerial decision that's not, you know, tactical, that Erik ten Hag has gotten wrong. And we've talked about injuries before, and, you know, with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, of depending on players who are clearly playing hurt, and every manager does that, obviously. But it's like, this is a series of things that's happening where I think the trust in Erik ten Hag is rightfully being questioned as, you know, the decision maker manager. Because you've got this, you've got the Jadon Sancho situation, which, you know, the dramatics, obviously Jadon Sancho has a part to play in that as well. But Erik ten Hag isn't exactly helping himself either with the way that this has all been handled, with, you know, not just making a big deal out of things in the first place and exiling him from the squad, but taking it a step further and exiling him from the facilities in general.
Right. Also, again, everybody else has an illness.
Yes.
With him, it's, I'm going to go and be like, actually, so I'm going to say it's something else that the player clearly disagrees with.
Yeah. And now you've also got Antony returning and available for selection tomorrow, after it seemed like they were going through the motions of, he's facing these domestic violence allegations, he's going to step away from things for a while. For a while ended up being like, what, 2 weeks?
19 days. 19 days.
Yeah. I think all of this stuff matters when it comes to evaluating, you know, the culture of a team, why they're struggling, and why the person in charge is failing to find answers.
Yeah, we saw this last January. was, I'm going to start from the beginning of whatever everything that Colin said. We saw this last January when he acknowledged Anthony Martial was not fit for the Derby, but he came to me and he said, I really want to play. And Anthony Martial is a big part of what Ten Hag wanted to do last season. And I know everybody just has their own narrative of Martial and, oh, he's injured and he's been terrible for years. Like, Martial was not fit a lot. He was fit from like the end of December, from like mid-December through the beginning of January, through mid-January. And United played a lot of matches in those games, and Martial was very good in them. And it was finally like, oh, he's rounding in form. And then he got hurt again, and then he came back, rushed back for the Derby, played well for 45 minutes, and then was out until like April. And when he came back in April, it's not even the performances. It's just him physically has never been the same. And that's hurting this year because you only have one striker. So he's still your backup. So you need to still rely on him, but he just doesn't have that burst of, it's not that like maybe he lost that burst of pace over the years, but now he doesn't even try it. He doesn't seem to trust his body anymore since that injury in January. And Lisandro Martinez, for all we know, like maybe he was better in preseason and maybe he did not come back prematurely in preseason and everything. But what we do know is that 2 days before the Arsenal match, he tweaked exactly that injury, exactly where he had surgery. He tweaked that in training. And that is where it becomes that's where it becomes an issue of like, if he tweaked it in training, you should have shut him down right there. But you made the choice to say, we need you to play Arsenal. Because otherwise we can't, you know, this Arsenal match is so important. We need the 3 points in this match on Labor Day weekend in September. When a baseball pitcher has like a big arm injury that keeps them out for, knocks them out for months, and then they come back and they're good in spring training and the season starts. And then in like mid-April, they're just like, oh, I have the teeny bit of soreness. It's no big deal. And the team shuts them down right away for a month. And they're just like, yeah, because it's far more important for us for you to be able to pitch June, July, August, September than for you to make 2 starts in April and then make it a lot worse. I don't blame any, like Collins alluded to, I don't blame any manager for doing this because the players, the team doctor declares them fit. Obviously the team doctor has the team's interest in mind. Most of these players have their own doctors who have their interests in mind. And so when everybody's saying, yeah, you're fit and you can play, and the player is knocking on the manager's door saying, I'm fit, I can play, the manager's going to pick them. Every manager will. And I don't blame managers for doing that in the same way that I don't blame players who are like, I'm only 93% fit. I don't want to risk it. Wait until I'm 100% fit. I don't blame them for saying that either and saying I'm not available. But when you make that decision, it can very much blow up in your face, and this is what can happen. And ultimately, this is, with hindsight, is he got it completely wrong.
I guess if I were to give Erik ten Hag any credit with some of the stuff too, it makes you wonder, what, I think it has to do with club structure. You know, what are, why does Erik ten Hag feel like he has to do this, right? You know, like, I understand that this is a results-based business, but for all intent and purposes, the communications have been like, we think we got our guy in Erik ten Hag, right? Like, we want to build around his vision, at least for right now. That's all seemed really well and good. So it seems like he's making a lot of short-term decisions when the messaging has been that we are working for the long-term. And it just makes you wonder, like, structurally, and it probably goes back to ownership and how we're just now getting a technical director or sporting director. And it doesn't seem like the foundation is as strong as you'd like it to be when United's on its what, fourth rebuild since 2012? Fifth rebuild?
There's no question there's structural issues within the club, but yeah. I think this is also a personal thing. I think
this probably comes down to when you let the manager pick all of his guys, and then the sporting director's like, cool, yeah. If that's what you think, man, like, we'll go sign him. And then all of a sudden, like, because a player like Antony, all Eric Ten Hag can look at is like, that's like my kid because I've been coaching him for so long. You know, it's pretty easy for him to set his morals to the side and just defend a player.
So. I mean, he did that for a guy he hadn't met.
Yeah. Before we even get there, like, let's even just back to Martinez. What ended up, according to Andy Mitten of The Athletic, is what ended up happening is United accepted the £30 million bid from West Ham for Harry Maguire. And then Eric Ten Hag ultimately stepped in and blocked it and did not give Maguire permission to speak to West Ham because he said, we're not selling you unless we get another player. And they made an inquiry about Benjamin Pavard. Then he left Bayern Munich and went somewhere else. He was off the market. So they went, all right, yeah, Maguire, you can't leave because we need this, our fourth choice center back. So if you aren't going to let him leave, that's because you're like, we're fine with you being here. Then you gotta trust him and use him. And if that means, look, maybe the thing is you took this risk and you lost against Arsenal anyway, which, all right, hindsight, 2020, but like, you should be able to look at the schedule and say, is 3 points against Arsenal or against anyone in September more important than a lot like Lisandro Martinez being out for now 3 months with however many points around? And this is a conversation for another time, but the reason I think that that's a personal choice in terms of yes is one, I mean, Ten Hag is not known to rotate his squad anyway. He's got his 11 guys and that's that, but it's partially because we have made every single match so important now. Every match. Like, think about the last game of the season last year. United finished in third place regardless of what happens. What's the difference between 72 points and 75 points? Nothing. Other than 75 is the second highest United have ever gotten after Sir Alex Ferguson, since Sir Alex Ferguson retired. That's kind of a big deal when you're up for contract negotiations and your agent can take that and be like, look at what this guy's accomplished. He won the club's first trophy in 6 years. He had the high, you know, and when Sky Sports is rolling out that graphic of Eric Ten Hag won more matches in his first year than anybody else because he played 63 matches and he it's like you had a dead rubber in the Europa in a group stage match or whatever. And he put out a strong team and won that match where it's like, you didn't need to win that match, but it counts there. So we can get into that at another time. But I think that weighs in to why some of these choices are made. And again, it blows up in your face, which is something that can happen, or it could have very much worked out for him. We're talking about this in hindsight.
I mean,
the Antony
we're one. We're looking at, before we get to Antony, we're looking at two Champions League group stage matches and probably two Premier League matches over the next four matches that are against not great opponents that you probably have to win regardless, like all four.
This
of
is like
matches.
Their third must win match, like already.
All four of these matches like coming up. Must win.
Right. I mean, did you see the tweet the other day? I mean, this kind of brings back to the Palace match. Did you see the tweet the other day that was when Ten Hag makes that thinking man emoji face? He's like, if you're watching United and you see Ten Hag making that thinking man emoji face, just know United are not getting 3 points that day. And someone posted a picture of him doing it at Ajax. And he's like, look at the score, man. They're down 2-0. Like, he's like, he's out of ideas. And yeah, we talked about it against Brighton when he moved Bruno Fernandes back to center back. And we're like, this kind of seems like this is like when you're admitting I'm out of ideas. And then against Burnley, all right, you come the next game, you got blown out by Bayern. Then you come back against Burnley, you get the win. Crystal Palace, you walk over their reserves. And then you come back against Crystal Palace and like with 5 minutes left, you're like, I'm going to throw on Harry Maguire and Donny van de Beek. And it's like, whatever idea that was, you need to give it more than, if there was a plan there, you need to give it more than 5 minutes. But that was very much like, I'm out of ideas. I'm just going with it.
I need my last ditch ideas to have a little bit more of a fuck it, we ball sort of vibe. But right. I guess I'll do this vibe.
Not I'm throwing Harry Maguire on at striker against Real Sociedad because we needed to beat them 2-0 and we've taken 4 shots in this game. But let's talk about Antony because it's a unique one in that I actually see both sides on this of it is hard to be like you've just been accused, so therefore you can't play anymore. But what if he turns out to be innocent? And that's there is some element of that, like he has not been charged yet. And I think that's the stance that the club obviously that's the stance the club wanted to take right away. My personal opinion is, well, if 3 people are accusing you of the same thing, that's awfully weird for all 3 of them to be lying. In light of the Mason Greenwood situation, it was like you can't do that because you handled that so poorly. So the club then kind of realized and they're like, well, we gotta go the other way on it. And then they went with the leave of absence and everything, and he's cooperating and everything. I think if he wasn't charged, like it is an unfortunate reality that there's other players in the league that are playing and they're in similar situations. And some of them have not been charged. Some of them have been arrested, but like are allowed to play. The club has no credibility over this right now. So when he comes back and when you go, all right, we're going to put him on a leave of absence. And it's like, while this thing plays out, okay, that's fine. You assume it's going to be a while and it turns out to be 19 days. And it's like, yeah, well, he cooperated with the authorities. He told the police and he stressed his innocence to the police and he hasn't been charged. And it's like, yeah, well, like that's not how it works. Like everybody will go to the police and say, yeah, everybody's going to go to the police and say, I didn't do it. And the police aren't going to be like, oh, he told us he didn't do it, but we're going to charge you. Like the police are or are not still building their case. And it's just like, he's still under investigation. So it's like, once you've gone down this road, it's very awkward to then be like, oh, well, okay. We're going to bring him back now, even though the investigation of the authorities is not complete. Like, weren't you putting him on leave of absence so he can deal with the investigation and be the cooperative person that he is being?
Not to give too much credit to like some of our American sports institutions who are vehemently bad at making decisions as well, but it is surprising that a league with such a, the Premier League is just as focused on their image and the viability of the product and the commercial prospects of the product. I'm surprised that they don't have a system that takes this out of the club's hands, kind of in the same way that, players that have been under investigation have been charged with things like in the NFL, the NBA, they get put on, whatever they call it, the commissioner's list, they get put on some kind of leave of absence where it is the league that has determined it. It hasn't been the club. So that way, at the very least, it takes the heat off of the club to make a moral decision. And so it's really put a spotlight, I think, on United, where they just can constantly shoot themselves in the foot, which it's quite bizarre that they keep going in this direction.
And again, the biggest thing is they have zero credibility here because of the fact, like in their statement, they said Antony maintains his innocence and his, whatever. I can't believe a word you said, because a month ago you released a statement that said we have evidence from Mason Greenwood that he is innocent of this crime. And basically,
we can't tell you about it.
What evidence? And they're like, oh, it's not public evidence, but it totally exists. And it's like, what are you talking about? Because there is very public evidence that says he does it. And they're like, no, believe us. We have evidence that actually says that audio recording and the pictures, not him. So once you've done that, like I can't take you seriously when you tell me, we've spoken with Antony and like he tells us he's innocent. It just sounds like that's their investigation was Antony told us he's innocent. And they're like, well, you're innocent.
I think people should and will say what they want about like the 1958 and their, you know, methods of like protesting the Glazers and, you know, reasoning and for maybe not clarifying what their position is on potential owners and things like that. Obviously, the 1958 are not a perfect organization, but they were spot on during the week that the Mason Greenwood news was coming out and pointing out exactly how disastrous the club is at doing anything. I mean, there was zero coherent strategy to anything with, you know, there was no commitment to one decision or another on the Mason Greenwood thing until like a month before they were going to announce the decision. And by then it was so shambolic that the club was leaking information to reporters to try and reverse the decision that was supposedly being made, which was then reversed very publicly and embarrassingly. Everything that they have to, you know, everything that the institution has to handle feels like it's just coming out with just more embarrassing examples of how nobody is on the same page. Nobody understands. And I hate to say like a way out of it, but like they literally have no control over whether Antony is convicted or not. That is not something they have control over. What they do have control over is whether he plays for Manchester United and whether they are willing to invite the kind of vitriol that potentially comes with him continuing to play for Manchester United for the time being. And instead of making a decision based off of that, they've made everything worse and drawn more attention to the situation by going back and forth on their decision-making.
I spoke to someone who said, oh, like reports coming out of Brazil actually are saying like he's going to be innocent. Like this will go away and they expect the investigation to wrap up really quickly. And that's going to be the outcome. And that's why United feel like they can bring him back right now. And it's like, well, if you think the investigation's going to be wrapped up in like the next 2 weeks, wait the damn 2 weeks. Like, again, what are you gaining from bringing him back this quickly? And all it looks like is, well, we lost to Arsenal, we lost to Brighton, we lost to Crystal Palace, we lost to Bayern Munich. That's where your priority lies. And like, as Mark Kastner said, the only decision that United have been able to make swiftly and stick to has been Jadon Sancho, you're not playing. And what does that say? Like, where are their priorities? Because obviously,
ultimate disciplinarian against Jadon Sancho.
Right. And like, even if we take it at face value of it's just, you can't blast your manager like that on the Twitter. It's like, there is clearly something else going on here in this scenario. And it's just like, nope, you're not playing.
I was thinking the other day, maybe we can, this will be a nice way to wrap up the pod. But last year, talking to Carl Anka and the Intorno of Manchester United and how this club is so massive now that it really just envelops an entire, I think social media has made it a lot different than it used to be, obviously, but it's like there is an entire cultural cycle that revolves around Manchester United and what happens there. And sometimes it fucking sucks, like right now. It's like, I feel like a lot of this has become so much worse because it is such a massive thing that envelops so many people and so many bot accounts that act like people. And it's starting to get sticky again. And I'm honestly not looking forward to the next few months of the season.
Yeah. Well, even
at this point,
on the other side of things, just the control that they've given Erik ten Hag, like, is, I'm not looking forward to the next few months because it just doesn't seem like it's going to get better on the pitch. Is, everybody has made excuses at the beginning of the season. Oh, we had injuries. You know, we had a tough schedule. It's like you're getting played off. You're losing to Crystal Palace now, and again, week one, you got played off the pitch by Wolves. Like you were outplayed by Burnley. It's not like you played Tottenham and you played Arsenal, and then your schedule got easier. Look at Newcastle's schedule. that's a club where, you know, they lost 3 out of 4 and we're like, yeah, okay, but they played Liverpool, Manchester City, and Brighton. Those are 3 good clubs. And then the schedule changed, and look at what Newcastle are doing now. They're just demolishing clubs. And the schedule changed for United, and they're not. And they're like, where is this going to come back? It's like, well, they're really relying on Casemiro and everything. And that comes from how much power they've given Erik ten Hag. Like I've said, sacking Erik ten Hag will do nothing. The same way that sacking Ralph Rangnick and all that. The problem isn't the manager, and no manager is coming in to fix this. But because they gave Erik ten Hag so much power, and he got to pick these guys, and he got to basically be like, this is my guy, sign him. And in an era where you don't get to just, if you want to spend 50 million and you spend 80 million, you don't get to just be like, oh, that's 30 million more than we wanted to spend, but like, whatever, we'll deal with it. It's like, no, that there's only so much you can spend. And therefore that extra 30 million is going to take away from something else. And when Erik ten Hag is saying, no, like you got to go and sign Antony, no matter the cost, and you end up spending an extra 30 million, it's, you're taking away from somewhere else on the pitch. So like, by giving him all that power, like he's now made himself part of the problem, because this collection of players are his. And at a certain point, the well's going to dry up. They've said, we spent 2 summers of transfer budget last year. And then this summer they were like, we don't have a lot to spend. And they didn't have a lot to spend. And at a certain point, like, they're going to be like, well, actually we still need to spend even less next summer. But like, hey, you've been building this team for 3 years. This is your team. So if they go and hire somebody new, it's like you're dealing with the same mess, but not as much flexibility to get out of it, that it makes it bleak long term. And part of that's, like, as Colin said, like the Intorno is, this was Manchester United needed a manager, and this was the guy, the hot guy at the time. They, you know, that you need someone with a big enough name at United. They wanted an up and coming guy that he ticked all the boxes. And it's a new regime, like John Murtaugh had just taken over, and you know, you want to try to do that. And it just seemed like they were trying something new, and but they didn't quite have the structure down. And this is where you end up.
So far they've gone with whatever David Moyes was, and then seasoned old guy to steady the ship, and then firebrand personality guy, Jose Mourinho. And then club legend, and now what, the fancy new kid on the block.
Right. David Moyes is supposed to be the stability. He'd been at Everton for like 12 years. So it was like, he's a long-term guy.
Right.
He's the chosen one.
Yeah.
The hand-picked protege.
Nathan, you really picked a great time.
And Adam Schiff.
Oh, God.
Nathan, you picked a good time to be busy during matches.
Yeah, when the season ends, the USL season ends, Nathan, you better buckle up.
Hey, man.
Actually,
2-2, baby. We're good.
You know what they can't? You know what they can't take away, though?
Our freedom. Not
they
can't take away that trophy from last year.
They can't take away 2-0 against Arsenal at MetLife Stadium.
That's right.
No, they.
Although the club tried to. The club tried to take it away from you guys.
No, I think that was Marriott Bonvoy, but
I think it was New York traffic. Which
New York traffic, and
I thought I knew
us
traffic.
Not listening to Polly.
Yeah,
yeah, just two bumpkins from the south being like, "Yeah, it's only 3 miles away. We'll get there, no problem."
Yeah, I've gone through a tunnel before. It's not that bad. I think that's going to do it for us on this episode. Real quick, Manchester United women's season started on Sunday, and they had a really nice 2-1 comeback win, and their new signings all look like they're, you know, fitting in real nice and going to work out. So that's a nice change of vibe. And they play Arsenal on Friday, so tune in to watch that on Paramount Plus, I think, if you're able. And we may have a podcast either this week or next week covering Manchester United women specifically coming out. So stay tuned for that as well. And Galatasaray tomorrow. And we'll be back on Monday next week.